Sure, you are ready for appellant. Let's just give respondent. Are you all ready?
I think I'm ready.
Okay. Okay. Counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Judge. My name is William Paul. I'm an attorney from here in Duluth. I represent the appellants in this case, which is the Wright Group LLC and Morex Properties, and also Bedrock CMS. I want to start out by saying, as the trial judge said in the record, Mr. Paul, there are going to be a lot of issues to be considered on appeal in this case. And she was absolutely right, as you can tell from appellant's brief and addendum. I'm going to start out with what I submit is one of the most glaring issues, and that relates to the motion in limine that really was a motion for summary judgment. And if you look at the brief, I point out the relief sought by the Allen Max entities, and in terms of what it's sought to exclude. And in that they list numerous things that they want to keep out, and they, if you look at them, any evidence of damage, any evidence of liability, any evidence that Allen Max Construction didn't.
I'm looking at it's at your agenda on page 39.
Thank you.
Specifically, which of those nine, well, actually, three of those were reserved and ultimately granted, so I could
right. Actually, all of them, Judge, but the most glaring one, number two, the percentage of work completed. The record in the way of offer of proof would have, if I was permitted to allow testimony in this regard, was permitted to introduce testimony in this regard, was that Allen Max Construction had completed 70% of the framing contract obligation. And then if you compare the amount of money that Allen Max Construction was paid, it equaled 90% of the entire contracted amount, with the remaining amount being retainage.
And interests and walk away from each other with that change order that indicated what was due on each of the contracts.
Well,
what difference does it make if 70 or 90% was done when they made an agreement that this is what's due now that we're separated?
Well, here's the difference, Your Honor. Again, and I wasn't allowed to introduce this, but the evidence would have shown that Morex Properties, the La Quinta developer, paid $250,000 of extra money in order to complete the framing contract.
Well, didn't they know that, though? I mean, they would have known, you know, we're saying you're done here, Allen Max. We'll hire someone else to finish the rest of it. I mean, presumably they should have known what more was left to be done. I mean, these are experienced business people.
Well, that arrangement, Judge Flory, was between the Wright Group and Allen Max Construction. And so Morex Properties, they're looking to the Wright Group, its agent, to arrange for that. And the Wright Group thought, okay, you're done as of January 30th. We're not owing you any more money. That was their impression by way of lien waivers and everything. And then suddenly, after the RMS lawsuit, because of course Allen Max Construction didn't pay RMS, unbeknownst to Morex Properties, they commence a lawsuit against the Wright Group. And then at that point, Morex is a defendant in this RMS lien foreclosure action, and Morex Properties sits back and says, wait a minute, we've paid everything that that Alan Max Construction asked to be paid. And what do you mean RMS has a lien against our property for 50-some thousand dollars?
And aren't those really two separate issues? I mean, number one, you're talking the breach of contract issues between whether it was 70% or 90% complete. And on the other hand, this RMS issue with the failure to pay the crane issue. I mean, it seems like those are separate issues in terms of the claim here. And if Marx didn't like the agreement that Wright, their agent, made for them, it seems like your fight's with Wright, not with Alan Max.
Well, and I mean, if you feel that way, Judge, that
my
position is this: that when Alan Max Construction sued the Wright Group for some, you know, $77,000, that the Wright Group ought to be able the opportunity to defend that, and then we specifically stipulated, Judge Flory, specifically that rather than Morex bring a separate action and litigated Morex versus Alan Max Construction and Alan Max Commercial under a third-party beneficiary, that it would be wiser and more efficient judicially and all the way around that Morex would be able to assert its third-party beneficiary claim in this lawsuit that was stipulated to, an order was entered, and I don't mean to be rambling, but the district court judge says, Mr. Paul, you never pled third-party beneficiary, and it's too late now. And that is, to me, glaring that she did not read the complaint, did not read the stipulation, just took at face value anything my opponent said. And, you know, it's never been pled. A third-party beneficiary has never been pled. And literally, and it's frustrating even to this day, anything I said was completely disregarded. You know, Judge, please look at the complaint. It's there, third-party beneficiary. There's a stipulation. There's an order. And then she said something along the line, well, that's maybe why we shouldn't have different judges on the case at the same time. I'm not trying to evade your question, Judge Flory, but... Of damage.
Damage, which was a result of what had to be paid to finish the project.
To other contractors that replaced the Alan Max entities after they were terminated.
And is it your argument, is it your argument that Wright was entitled to that money?
No.
Okay, your argument is only that Morex was.
Absolutely.
And that Morex was entitled to that as a third-party beneficiary of the contract of Wright.
Between... Because that, and no one, I don't believe, Judge, disputes that the intended beneficiary of this construction contract was Morex Properties, the owner of the property. When the Wright Group contracted with the Alan Max entities, the person who ultimately benefits from that contract is Morex Properties. The Wright Group didn't pay any bills, Judge, to... or any of the draw requests to Alan Max Construction. What would happen, and that's clear, I think, from appellant's brief and addendum, Alan Max Construction would submit a draw request. It would be presented to Doug Wright of the Wright Group. Doug Wright would look it over, looks okay, send it on to Virginia Stockburger from Morex Properties, and then Morex Properties would green light authorize the release of $111,000, for example. So always the beneficiary of this contract was always Morex Properties, and I don't think that was ever a dispute. That's why we entered into a stipulation that allowed Morex Property to assert its damage claim in this lawsuit. It was reduced to an order, then incredibly, 5 days before trial or whenever, it's claimed by my opponent that third-party beneficiary was never alleged. Judge Neal said, Mr. Paul, you never pled third-party beneficiary. And, I mean, by then, way before then, I knew I was in trouble in terms of, when I say way before then, when she granted each and every motion in limine, you know, no defenses, no claim for damages, no nothing, granted. So basically, when I started trial, all the discovery that had taken place for the year and a half before was rendered moot. And I want to emphasize this. When the defendant, respondent, originally brought a motion for summary judgment on the issue of Morex damages and on the issue of civil theft and on the issue of evidence. That motion was denied on the 89th day following the day that the motion was argued. That's clear in the record by virtue of an order. Motion for summary judgment denied. The civil theft claim survives. Morex's damages claim survives, et cetera, et cetera. You can see it for yourself. And then 2 weeks before trial, this motion in limine, and then the Friday before the start of the Tuesday trial, granted, 6 out of 9 granted, and then by the time the morning the trial started, everything was granted. And that's when I said, Judge, may I bring a motion to recuse? She said, Mr. Paul, you know the drill. You can file an affidavit. Then you can, if you don't like my ruling following the affidavit, you can file with the chief judge. Your Honor, may I have leave to do that? No. And at that point, I'm a little hamstrung. Do I disregard her direction that I'm not permitted to do that, or do I do it anyway? I'm caught between a rock and a hard spot, and obviously I did not do that because she told me that I couldn't, and here we are. And so I'd like to concentrate for a second, or mention for a second, the Crane bill. And the dismissal of the civil theft claim. The undisputed fact is that each draw request made by Allen Max Construction, and for that matter, Allen Max Commercial, but for the purpose of the crane rental, Allen Max Construction, each draw request was reviewed, it was approved, and it was paid. 1, 2, 3, and I think 4, but if 4 wasn't, then forgive me. And in those draw requests, it was specifically represented by Mr. Bellinger that road machinery and supply would be paid. One has $22,000, another has another 20, another has another 17. None of those payments were made except for a $14,000 payment. And so imagine Virginia Stockburger from Morex Property Surprise when the La Quinta Hotel gets a mechanics lien filed against it by Road Machinery and Supply. And then Tom Bellinger admits in emails, these are all part of the record, but none of it came in because, of course, my civil theft claim was dismissed on the morning of trial. But I was able to cross-examine him at trial. This was not true, was it, Mr. Bellinger? You didn't take any portion of this 122 and paid RMS. And, you know, no. And 117, none. So when you gave Ms. Stockburger a lien release saying that all suppliers had been paid in full, that wasn't true, was it? No. But it's all for naught because by then the district court judge said that I couldn't pursue a civil theft claim. For reasons that still aren't clear to me. Let's see here. So the motion in limine, the Hebrick case, that Farm Bureau Hebrick case, where it's literally on all fours. In that case, the party seeking a motion in limine did so shortly before trial. This is at page 25 and 26. Of my 26 and 27, I quote at length. You all know what a motion in limine is designed to do. It's to keep out prejudicial, irrelevant evidence that you know doesn't go to the heart of the matter. But when a motion in limine is brought right before trial to seek the exclusion of evidence of damages, evidence of liability, any evidence at all that goes to the theory of the plaintiff or defendant's case, how that is not a motion for summary judgment, to me, belies common sense. I made this argument prior to trial, and obviously any argument that I made in that regard was rejected by the court. Another thing that I'd like to mention is the fact that the contract between the Wright Group and the Allen Max entities provided that unless the Wright Group was paid by the owner for monies that Allen Max Construction and Allen Max Commercial were claiming, unless the owner didn't pay the Wright Group would have no liability to pay Allen Max Commercial or Allen Max Construction. That argument is set forth, and it's a very brief one, but the provision in the contract is quite...
Can you explain why that provision in the contract continues if that contract is terminated with a change order?
Well, I would cite, and I'm not trying to be a smart aleck, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. It would seem to me that the termination, it was the expectation by the Wright Group and Morex Property that upon the termination of the contract, that terminated the contract. That was it. No one's going after anybody else. It's over and done with. But then after the RMS settlement by Allen Max Construction, incidentally, and I indicate this, Morex Properties did not contribute to that settlement. I just had to defend it, and I was able to persuade Allen Max Construction to pay it in its entirety based upon the civil theft theory. But once that was terminated, or excuse me, once that litigation finished, imagine our surprise when then Allen Max Commercial and Construction commenced this lawsuit against the Wright Group. Apparently it wasn't terminated, and it was at that juncture that either you just defend the lawsuit or you counterclaim, and that's what we elected to do on behalf, and that's when I said, hey, you know, it'd be smart to get Morex Properties into this, and we entered into that stipulation as part of the record, and it was reduced to order, and then I was obviously never permitted to pursue that claim, unbelievably, on the morning of trial. And that's the last thing is, I have no idea how the court could grant judgment as a matter of law for $32,700 against the Wright Group, against the Wright Group, no evidence, no testimony, no documents, no nothing. I'm sorry, Judge, I'm done. Thank you. Appreciate it.
5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Adina Bergstrom. I represent the respondents in this matter, Allen Max Construction and Allen Max Commercial. This construction project involved my clients, one as a construction project manager, one as the framer. They entered into two separate contracts with the Wright Group. They never had a contract with Morex, who is the property developer and the owner of the project. The contractual relationship was only with the Wright Group. There's been no stipulation that Morex was a third-party beneficiary, and the stipulation that was entered into this case allowed Morex to participate as a necessary party. I will not belabor the fact and will instead turn the court's attention to the stipulation itself. Nowhere in that stipulation does it state that there's a third party beneficiary status. Rather, it says that Morex is being joined as a necessary party, that there are going to be no new claims brought. And at that point in the case, the claims that had been brought against my client as counterclaims were breach of contract, negligent or defective construction, and civil theft. That's what had been asserted by the Wright Group, and Morex simply joined into the action. There was an amended counterclaim that was served. There was one line that said, Morex is a beneficiary, and I will submit to this court. That's not enough. There's no claim or count ever pursued for third-party beneficiary, which is a very different claim than straight breach of contract. It's the exception to the rule that strangers to a contract somehow get rights. And it's very specific in Minnesota. The Cretex case is one of the leading cases in Minnesota that talks about it, and it adopted the intended beneficiary test. You need to allege and you need to prove that you are an intended third-party beneficiary under a contract. Simply being a beneficiary of some sort is simply not enough. In fact, that is correct, Your Honor. Yes.
I want to turn to the unjust enrichment award against Morex, who's not a party to the contract.
Correct.
You seem in your brief to argue, I think we have explicitly argued, that that award of, what was it, $22,000 something, was not based on the crane rental.
That is correct.
Okay.
Certainly, Your Honor. First of all, there seems to be a continued misconception by appellants as to the crane rental. So on the various lien waivers that were signed throughout the project, there was a line for crane charges. There's been lots of testimony, tons of testimony at trial, with other evidence that talks about what that meant. It meant crane rental. It meant crane labor. It meant fuel for the cranes, generators for the cranes. It was an all-encompassing number for the crane. That's number one. So it wasn't just the rental issue. In terms of the unjust enrichment, it was never limited to just cranes. The unjust enrichment arises out of, as Your Honor has correctly noted, there was no contract with the Morex Group. That's why we brought an unjust enrichment claim. The unjust enrichment was based... So the damages for unjust enrichment were essentially that. It was unfair. We didn't argue a specific damages number. We left that to the jury. One of the things that we did submit, number one, was that Morex received a beautiful hotel for the work that Allen Max Construction had done on the project, for which they had never been compensated by anyone. There were daily logs showing all the work that they did. There was lots of testimony about all the work that they performed. And ultimately, Morex was enriched by that because they now own this beautiful hotel. Your Honor, you know, in terms of the unjust enrichment piece, at this point, because there was not any further questions on the verdict form or interrogatories that were submitted by appellants in terms of clarifying those issues, it would be improper now to go back and recall the jury or try to speculate as to how they ascertained that number. But there certainly is evidence in the record about the total amounts that were unpaid, overpayments that were made to Wright by Morex that were not returned, some of which were very clearly intended for Allen Max and then not paid on to them. And then there was testimony about the crane. There was testimony that Morex knew that the crane rental had not been paid because the principal of Allen Max Construction, Mr. Bellinger, had an agreement with RMS, with whom he had established commercial working relationship in the past, that they would be paid at the end of the project. But that payment was never forthcoming, and that created a cash flow problem. Morex was fully aware of this. Morex agreed in emails, and that was actually submitted as a trial exhibit, exhibit 32 at trial, where they agreed to pay half of those crane charges. This was long before RMS brought any sort of lien action, and they never followed through on that promise. So is there a basis there? Absolutely. Yes, it does, Your Honor. And again, it would be improper now for us to go back and speculate on that issue. And, you know, in terms of the finality of those issues, Kath versus Burlington, which is one of the cases we cited, talk about the fact that you have to be very specific on a verdict award. And if you're not specific, then you waive that issue. And in fact, I would submit to this court that the appellants, to the extent that they want to challenge that, and it's not clear to me that that's something that's been challenged on this appeal, that would be waived at this point in time. That is true, in fact, of the many different ways that now the appellants are seeking to attack the jury verdict after hearing 3 days of trial about the contracts, what they meant overall, what the intent of them was, whether there was a breach, all of which were submitted to the jury, all of which were fact issues that the jury decided. We had an agreed-to verdict form that my office drafted and appellant's counsel agreed to. There was one damages number for breach of contract and very standard civil jury instruction guide questions on that verdict form. Was there a breach? Did it cause damage? And then a damages number. To go back now and try to itemize, was it retainage? Did they comply with the paid when paid clause? All of those things are now beyond the scope of review because the jury found there was a breach, whether it was because they breached the contractual terms, whether it's because they breached for non-payment, whether it was because they breached for breaching the duty of good faith and fair dealing. We cannot go back and speculate on that now. Poplar versus Wright Hennepin Group is very instructive in terms of the damages issues. And that really comes into play with this argument that somehow it was improper to deny JMOL after trial to the appellants on the issue of retainage, and that's specifically with respect to the Wright Group. That in Poplar, that was a dairy farm case where they had sued the electrical co-op for some stray voltage that caused damage to their dairy herd. They had an expert that had damages overall to the dairy herd that were itemized into 6 or 7 different categories. The court declined to itemize all the damages on the special verdict form, and after trial, there was a motion under Rule 49 for the judge to go back and itemize, and the Supreme Court has said that's improper. You can't do that. You can't go back afterwards and speculate on how the jury came up with their damages number. You have to have evidence to support it, of course, but you can't, even if the number matches exactly, which was actually the issue in the Poplar case, we still can't speculate in retrospect how the jury determined that number. The exact same issue is present here.
Can we turn to the JMOL in favor of commercial?
Yes. That is correct.
Okay. Can you explain to us procedurally how and when JMOL was granted, date was granted on that, what the respond to the damages amount issue that was raised, and then also explain to me, was this deposition testimony that you're citing available and presented to the judge at the time of JMOL? I know it talks about later that it was later, deposition was later introduced at trial, but I think it was a pre-trial.
Correct. So, I'd like to. And one issue that I do think that I need to raise with this court is it is unclear whether the JMOL that has been granted to Allenmax Commercial is actually before this court, because it was not briefed. Those issues were not briefed in appellant's brief. So there is a waiver issue there that seriously needs to be considered. There's one throwaway line that says, and by the way, JMOL was granted to Allenmax Commercial, but it's not briefed to any extent or supported by any case law as to why it was erroneous. So I would present that it's been waived. But to Your Honor's point, the JMOL was brought on the first day of trial, and that's appropriate under Rule 50. 50.01b says JMOL may be brought during trial at any time before submission of the case to the jury. On the first day of trial, and it was done in part because it was an efficiency measure. In terms of deposition testimony, the deposition of Doug Wright, who's the principal of the Wright Group, and of Virginia Stockberger, who is the CFO of Morex, were taken late in the case. Ms. Stockberger's deposition was taken 2 weeks before trial. Doug Wright's was taken shortly before that. So we have some very late depositions that are happening in the case. As a result of those depositions, we had admissions, such as, Doug Wright testified, I'm not pursuing any damages against LMX Construction. I have no counterclaims. We're simply defending. Because of that, it then only makes sense that not only would testimony about counterclaims by the Wright Group not be relevant, but if they don't have a claim, why would we present that claim to the jury when he's already admitted that they're not pursuing the claim?
So,
right, an Allenmax Commercial's claim. Right. So, and in terms of Allenmax Commercial's claim, Doug Wright admitted that he reviewed the final change order. He approved the final change.
In deposition.
Correct.
In deposition testimony. JMOL was granted.
Correct.
On commercial's claim in their favor before there's trial.
That is correct.
I'm asking on what evidentiary basis was JMOL granted in their favor before trial?
It was based on the deposition admissions of Mr. Wright. They were, and I'm sorry if I didn't address that directly. That was submitted to the district court, which is a little bit unusual because, JMOL can be done orally. We actually prepared a memorandum of law. We provided her with exhibits. We provided her with a full basis for our reasons why we believed JMOL was appropriate, and it was. The court ruled properly on that issue. Unless Doug Wright was going to get on the stand and perjure himself, which is an unrealistic expectation, And I don't believe that Mr. Paul would allow that to happen. I don't believe that any officer of the court would or should, unless he was going to perjure himself.
By saying that he didn't owe money.
Correct. Because he already agreed that he did. He agreed to the amount. He agreed that he approved and signed off on those change orders. And he testified that he didn't know why it hadn't been paid. And really, between commercial and construction, commercial was the much smaller amount of the overall claim than the construction side, where there was a lot more dispute over what applied and what was owed and what was still governing the party's relationship.
Can you tell me, looking at
sure. Yes.
I think the damages that were alleged in the civil theft were basically attorney's fees.
That is correct.
Why? What explains the motion in limine to exclude that, and then therefore to grant you as well?
Right. So the reason why the motion in limine was brought was, number one, we went through two discovery motions in this case. We went through almost 2 years of litigation and never once received any supporting evidence of what their damages were.
Was there an interrogatory response?
There was an interrogatory response. However, at Ms. Stockberger's deposition, she disclaimed having any knowledge of what the attorney's fees were. She disclaimed that she had ever reviewed the bills, had ever received them, knew what work was done, knew what the hourly amount was being charged by counsel. She had no knowledge of these damages. Therefore, she didn't have the foundation under 602 to testify. And there's a late disclosure issue there in terms of my client's abilities to look at that information and assess whether they're reasonable or not. Because even taken, I know that in the brief, there's been an allegation that the fees were about $7,000. I will submit to you that at trial, there was evidence submitted under Exhibit 54 of the amount that counsel for RMS, who was the prosecuting attorney, collected as a result of the settlement, and it was less than half that amount. So there's definitely a reasonable issue there where my clients were prejudiced by the non-disclosure of that information, and there's no excuse why it wasn't disclosed to us. There was no information provided in the exhibits. I mean, you have to think, too, that the JMOL issue on that particular claim was actually decided when we were at trial, because the judge actually reserved that issue. And so there was no, when, by the time we got to trial, this is JMOL number 9, the court had reserved the issue. It was not brought up the morning of trial. There was no offer of proof made by the appellant's attorney as to what would have been shown, and that's all required under the evidentiary standards. You have.
I thought I saw a reference to an invoice being produced.
I did not see that, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yeah, and regardless, when my time is up, I apologize. I would just ask the court to affirm the trial court's evidentiary rulings in this matter. I would ask the court to uphold the verdict in this matter with respect to the denial of the post-trial motions, uphold the JMOL granted to my clients to the extent that's even at issue, and to also affirm the trial court's decision not to recuse herself in this matter. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge. I'd like to address three issues. The first one, Judge Smith, related to your query to counsel about whether a copy of the attorney fee invoice incurred on behalf of Morex was ever submitted into evidence. It's part of the record, number one, and Ms. Bergstrom's associate attorney, Dana Johansson, acknowledged to the court receipt of that prior to the JMOL. So, and that's in the record, and Ms. Johansson testified. Unfortunately, there's hundreds of pages of transcript testimony, but I'll represent to you that the attorneys for Ellen Max Construction, and which was failed to pay the crane, had a copy of my $7,000-some-odd.
I
can't be sure if it was supplied before the deposition of Virginia Stockberger, but it was certainly supplied shortly after the deposition of Virginia Stockburger, again,
as...
Well, it was presented to the respondents in the form of an email attachment. You know, whether I ever offered it as proof, I can't say that I did, but...
I'm just wondering what proof did the district court make in a decision about the evidence that supports the claim?
And I'm reluctant to say this, but it's the truth. It didn't really matter what the district court had in front of it, because whatever representations were made by my opponent were carte blanche believed. For example, the
third... It matters to us when you're reviewing a record. So, but if you don't know, that's okay.
I just don't know. Okay. I represented, and as agreed to by Ms. Johansson, that they had a copy of the invoice prior to the JMOL. Of that, I am positive.
But you're just not sure whether or not it was presented to the district court at all?
I am not sure.
Okay.
But it may well be that in the hundreds of pages of exhibits, it exists there. I'd also point out this. Counsel admits that the motion for JMOL was based upon deposition testimony taken 2 weeks prior to trial. Now, the fact that the Alan Max attorneys waited until 2 weeks before trial to take the depositions of all of these folks over my objection, but Judge Neal said, nope, they're going to be permitted to take the depositions 2 weeks prior to trial, long after discovery has ended. So there were a flurry of depositions taken down in Minneapolis, Virginia Stockburger, Doug Wright, Brian Anderson, Nate Basner, who came up from Iowa, who's not even a party, but Judge Neal ordered that I have him appear. I don't represent him. But so we've got at least four depositions taken 2 weeks before trial. And counsel just admitted to you folks that her motion for a JMOL was based upon those depositions. Doesn't that sound like a motion for summary judgment? And don't the rules of civil procedure require 28? They didn't even take discovery depositions 28 days before trial, never mind bringing a motion for summary judgment 28 days before trial. They brought a motion for summary judgment couched as a motion in limine 15 days before trial, which was heard 1 week before trial, which was granted on in its entirety at 1:37 on a Friday before the Tuesday start of trial. And then on the morning of trial, JMOL was granted on all sorts of different claims. I found it unbelievable then, and I continue to find it unbelievable. And I hope that you will apply the law as it is in Hebrick versus Farm Bureau Insurance Company, where the court should not even have considered the motion for JMOL because it really was a motion for summary judgment and none of the rules in that regard were complied with. The other thing that I wanted, Ms. Bergstrom says, look at the stipulation relative to the admission of the allowance of Morex as a party. And I'm going to read just one sentence, and this is at page 35 and 36. Whereas all parties presently named and their attorneys agree that in the interest of judicial economy and efficiency, Morex Property should be joined as a party to this case so that its claims for damages may be litigated and resolved in this case. And Ms. Bergstrom, for the first time today, admitted that I did plead that Morex Property was a beneficiary, but now she makes a distinction. That doesn't mean that I pled that it was a third-party beneficiary. This is a notice pleading state, but earlier it was represented that I didn't plead it at all. Judge Neal agreed with that. Mr. Paul, you didn't plead it, she says. It's too late now. I'm going to grant the motion for JMOL dismissing any damage claims by Morex Properties. That was improper, as was a whole litany of other things. I hope at a minimum you grant my clients a new trial. Thank you very much for your attention. Appreciate it.
Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments and your briefing. We'll be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory time. Thank you.